You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. The Influential Mind is a cutting-edge research-based inquiry into how we influence those around us and how understanding the brain can help us change minds for the better. Part of our daily job as humans is to influence others. We teach our children, guide our patients, advise our clients, help our friends, and inform our online followers. We do this because we each have unique experiences and knowledge that others may not. But how good are we at this role? Tali Sharratt has written the book, The Influential Mind, and she joins us live on the line now from the US. Tali, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about how we can influence our clients, guide our patients, and choose our children.
I think one of the important things to understand is that we have habits of how we think we should influence people that don't really work very well, and they're not really compatible with how the brain works. So for example, we tend to think that if we disagree with someone, we will just give them the data and the information to show that we are right and they are wrong. And that actually approach usually backfires, because when people get information that disagrees with what they already believe, they tend to either ignore that information or they tend to rationalize it away. But there are strategies that work better. One, for example, is to try to tap into what people want to believe and what they are ready to believe. So start with things that we agree on and go from there, rather than start off just with all the stuff that we disagree on and try to back up the data and the information.
So we're looking at perhaps subtly influencing somebody who doesn't perhaps agree with our point of view or take our information on board?
Right, but also influencing their action. So let's take, for example, you want to convince your partner to start exercising. So you give them all the data that suggests exercising is really good for you. It will make you healthier. It will make you fitter. But if someone doesn't exercise, usually that information doesn't really motivate them to do so, right? There has to be some other strategies that would work better. So for example, what we find is that immediate rewards, things that will help you right now rather than things in the future, work better. So instead of telling someone, well, if you exercise now, later on in the future, you'll be healthier and fitter, that doesn't really work well, because people think, well, by the time, you know, I'm older, I'll be fine. But if there's something we can give them now as an immediate positive reward, for example, someone goes to the gym and you straight away say, oh, you look so good now. It really changed the way that you looked at the moment. Or give them some kind of reward for doing something at that moment. Those tend to work better because the brain processes reward that we get now as more valuable than things that we can get in the future.
So how did you come to research this book? I believe you did quite a lot of looking at the latest research into neuroscience.
Well, I think there was a few things. I had a book called The Optimism Bias that was talking about how people predict the future to be better than what it actually ends up being on average. And after the book came out, a lot of people asked me, well, what does this all tell us about how we need to interact with other people? How does understanding the minds of the people around us will help us in affecting their behavior for the better, which is something that we do all the time, right? So we want to educate our kids, we want to help our friends and our employees. And so the question was, well, what can we know from the brain that can help us in that domain? So it really came from the readers of the last book.
So one of the main mistakes that people make when they're trying to win somebody around to their point of view, it can be, you know, speaking at a business conference or arguing or trying to get a point across with friends and family, is it that they mainly try and scare and bulldoze their opinions and flatten the opinions and disregard the opinions of others?
Right. So the first one, as we said, is just using data and graphs and figures without involving it in emotion, in a story, in something that really touches on people's desires, really core desires. The second thing that people tend to do is they tend to exert control. So I'm going to tell you what to do. But in fact, in order to influence people, we need to expand their sense of agency. One of the main things of what the brain is trying to do is trying to control our environment in order to get rewards and avoid harm. And so by telling people how they have a choice, making them feel that they have agency, they have control, they can make their choice on their own, actually is a better way to influence than trying to exert control. One other thing that we do is we assume that we can scare people into acting one way or the other. We tell them, if you smoke, you will get cancer. If you don't get your report in time, you won't get that promotion. But in fact, what we find that scaring people causes them to freeze, not to act. So scaring causes inaction. But using an approach where we reframe the message to tell them what are the possible rewards in the future rather than the possible punishments, that actually enhances action. So instead of saying, if you smoke, you will get cancer, you might say, well, if you don't smoke, your skin will be nicer. Or you can say, instead of saying, well, this report is really bad and it is unlikely to get you a promotion, you say, well, if you do A, B, and C to correct this report, then we will have a good report that will enhance your likelihood of promotion. So highlighting progress, not decline.
So are we basically saying that if you go on an aggressive tack, a fear-based tack, by saying if you smoke, you'll get cancer, you know, if you don't get that report in, you will lose any chance of a promotion, then the brain basically, it's almost like a fight or flight mode, but in this case it freezes and it will subliminally shut down.
Yeah, so there's basically two reasons. One is, as you say, our response to fear is flight, fight, or freeze. And really, the first reaction that we have is freeze. So you may have noticed that if you kind of cross the road and you suddenly see a car coming, the first thing you do is you just freeze. Only then you start running. So our first response is actually freezing, because the expectation of something bad causes us to freeze in our place. So that's one problem. And it doesn't enhance motivation, right? So it's more predicting, anticipating rewards in the future that enhances motivation. And the second reason is that people tend to think about possible future harm as, well, it probably will be okay. It's probably not going to happen. So they tend to disregard warnings, but when you suggest that things can get better, they take that into account and really listen to what you have to say.
In the book,
it's just a matter of reframing the message.
Right. In the book, you look at the hidden power of influence, both good and bad, and also you identify instances in which we fall prey to delusions. What do you mean by falling prey to delusions?
Well, there's I'm not sure which part you were talking about, but there's many biases that our brain has. And these are systematic biases and illusions, which means that if I have them, you're likely to have them too. So one example is an example that I mentioned before, is that people tend to think things will be better than they end up being, what's known as the optimism bias. And it's something that most people have. It's a systematic bias. So if we make decisions together, those kind of biases can actually expand in a group, right? So because everyone has similar kind of biases, when you interact and you decide on group action, those biases can become bigger and bigger.
So why did you decide to write this particular book, The Influential Mind, and what do you hope that the readers will get out of the book?
Well, the book is really about how the brain forms beliefs and how it generates opinions. And the idea is, well, if we know the basic mechanisms by which the brain forms beliefs, and beliefs can be anything, like, do I believe in climate change? Do I believe that my kids will grow up to be successful? Do I believe that my own life will go in a positive path? Do I believe that exercising is healthy? So if we understand how the brain forms beliefs, we will be better able to alter those beliefs in other people for the better, and also in ourselves, to motivate ourselves for the right actions.
And how much do we know then? Because this book draws on the latest research. I mean, how much do we know about the brain, and how much still remains, do we think, to be discovered about our brains?
Yeah, so the exciting thing is that neuroscience is a relatively new domain. If you compare it to, you know, physics or chemistry, it's relatively new. And that's quite exciting because we're just starting to understand all these principles. And of course, there's much, much more to learn. But there's some principles that are really helpful and can really explain why things happen in the world. So, for example, there's one chapter on stress. And what I explained there is that being under stress really changes the way that the brain works, and it really changes the way that the brain processes information, making us actually more hypervigilant to any negative information. So it's really important to take into account the mental state of the person in front of you, because under different mental states, people would be more receptive to different kind of information. And this is why, for example, after terrorist attacks, what we find is that people overreact. So even if the terrorist attack took place all the way, on the other side of the world, that causes stress in individuals, and it makes them hypervigilant to any negative information that they hear in the news, and that makes them become even more pessimistic, and that causes more stress. Same thing happens after natural disasters, for example, or after financial market collapse. So understanding kind of the interaction between emotion and how we process information is really helpful to understanding the world around us.
So I suppose in a way you can also have to be quite careful of what you let filter in through the brain. If a terrorist attack, if a natural disaster, if a financial market crash is making you and making you process information in a different way, then surely how you receive that information, i.e. if you spend 24/7 on certain internet sites, you're going to come off with a very stressed and therefore a very negative view of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And it actually can cause us to take actions that are not very optimal for us. So for example, you know, people may buy insurance for earthquakes, even though they're living in an earthquake-free zone. Or after financial collapse, what we find is that people tend to start selling their stocks when really they should hold on. So under stress, we become risk-averse. We become very conservative, and sometimes it causes us to take choices and take decisions that are not very good for us in the long term.
So how then can we make sure that our brain processes information correctly, that we can use our minds for the better? You know, as a starter's guide, Tali, what should we be doing? What should we be focusing so that we can make our own brains better, and also the environment around us, the people that we influence, and have a more positive outlook, which is obviously what you're trying to do with the book?
Yeah, so I think that the key here is awareness. Once we really become aware of all these causes and effects and how the brain works, then we, when it happens to us, we can kind of pause and think, oh, this is what is happening. And so I need to reevaluate what I'm doing. I need to reevaluate how I'm processing this. So becoming aware means that we have more control over the way that we think and our actions too.
The book is called The Influential Mind. It's published in hardback by Little and Brown. It's by Tali Sharrett. Tali, what is, after a project like this, what is the next thing that you will be working on?
Oh, well, I mean, my daytime job is being a neuroscientist and running a lab. So we do experiments to try to understand the human brain and the human behavior, and that's what we're going to continue doing.
As I said before, the book's called The Influential Mind. Tali Sharrett, thank you for your time today.
Okay. Thank you so much.